This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lee Goff, helps investigate murders by examining evidence that would turn most people's stomachs. He's a forensic entomologist. He studies the insects living in recently discovered decomposing bodies. The type of insects and their stages of development offer clues about the time of death and other pertinent information. Forensic entomology is a relatively new profession. Goff has been at it since the early 80s. He's a consultant to the medical examiner of the city and county of Honolulu and a professor of entomology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. He discusses his work in his new book, A Fly for the Prosecution. I asked him about the questions insect evidence can help answer in addition to time of death.
Well, time of death still accounts probably for about 98% of what we do. But we're also helpful in providing some estimates of movement of the body. You know, insects are everywhere, but you don't find all insects in all places. Some are quite specific to a particular locality. And if we find something that's out of place, we can tell that the body was moved. We also work in assessment of wounds, the response of insects to a wound that occurs while the individual's still alive when blood's flowing is quite different from the response to a postmortem wound. So we can tell if something happened to the body before death, kind of around the time of death, or basically after death.
What's the difference?
Well, in terms of the blood flowing, this is very attractive to the flies. And so they're going to come in very quickly to that particular site, begin investigating it. The females or males will take a meal from the flowing blood, and the females will lay their eggs. If the blood is not flowing, then they will not be as attracted to this particular wound. This is something that happened to the body after death. It's probably not associated with the cause of death. We find with the flies a very definite pattern of invasion of the body. They tend to go around the natural body openings initially, go to the head, looking around the eyes and nose, go down to the anus and genitals as a secondary level. And then the third choice is going to be one of these wounds where you really don't have a lot of blood flowing.
Would you give us an example of a case that you worked on and helped solve by analyzing the insect presence in the corpse?
Well, gee, several come to mind. Probably one of the more interesting ones was a woman whose body was found on the north shore of the island of Oahu. And the body, when it was found, was wrapped in several layers of blankets. They had an idea the woman had been, well, she'd been missing for about 2 weeks. They had a pretty good idea as to the location because the suspect, who was her estranged husband, in fact, tended to frequent that area, went out. When I took a look at the body, found that we had three species of maggots that were present, and we had intact pupa. Okay, this is the stage between the maggot and the adult fly. None of the pupae had emerged. So this indicated we were on the first generation of flies. Took those back to my laboratory, reared them at a known temperature, figured out that basically we had about 10 days between the time I collected the pupae and the flies had first laid their eggs, working backwards. The woman had been missing at that point for about 13 days. I could account for actually 10 and a half days of development, figuring that if you wrap something up, the insects are not going to be able to get there very quickly. And I was pretty confident with that. Wrote up a report saying that I could account for 10 and a half days of the insect activity. Chances are it was longer than that because the body had been wrapped. I was pretty comfortable with that. Medical examiner was happy with it. The police were happy with it. Prosecutor was happy with it. However, the defense attorney was unhappy with it. He had another individual, aside from his client, that he wanted to pin this particular murder on, or at least introduce evidence that this individual might have been the person who actually did the killing. So he kept calling me and calling me, and finally I reached the point I was getting a little tired of his phone calls. So I decided I'd conduct an experiment. I got a 50-pound pig, which is what we normally use as a model for decomposition, and I got a couple of blankets, duplicated the wrappings, and then I started looking for a place that was pretty similar to the area in which the body had been found. Basically, I went out in my backyard. My wife wasn't too happy with that one, but the neighbors were kind of a little leery. The dog thought it was great. And I kept checking to see when the insects would come in. Turns out it took them 2.5 days to penetrate those wrappings and lay their eggs. The 2.5 days added to the 10.5 gave us 13, which very firmly placed the victim in the company of the suspect.
So that helped you solve the crime. Was the suspect convicted?
Yes, he was.
Mm-hmm. You compare a decomposing corpse to a barren volcanic island that has recently emerged from the ocean.
Yeah, when you have an island that's just coming up out of the ocean, it's barren, it's kind of isolated from other things by a geographic barrier. First thing that happens is usually you get plants coming in, and they'll take root and grow. As they do, they kind of change the island a little bit. And by changing it, then they make it suitable for other plants and animals to come in. These get there, and they change the island some more. Each one of these changes is a step in succession. And the dead body is not really that dissimilar. It's usually sitting somewhere where there aren't other dead bodies around. It's a resource waiting to be exploited. And the first insects that come in are your flies. And as they feed on the body, they change the body. And those changes then make the body attractive to another group of insects that will come in, who feed on the body, and thus change the body again. And you have the same pattern of succession.
Now, you know, in comparing the dead body to the barren volcanic island, the first insects that come in feed on the body, but then insects start coming in that feed on the other insects, as well as feeding on the body, and you get this whole ecosystem developing.
Yeah, it is. It's a fascinating little series of interactions and things. It's very complex. You have the necrophages. They're your insects that are actually feeding on the body. Then we have the predators that come in and feed on those. Then we have parasites that come in and parasitize things. We have some that just happen to fall onto the body and aren't necessarily doing anything with it. But it's a very complicated system, and analyzing it is really intriguing. You can spend hours and get kind of lost in what you're doing. Almost forget that you're actually a dead body that you're dealing with.
Well, from the book, it makes it sound like you kind of want to forget that it's a dead body that you're dealing with. You talk about how you try not to think of it as being a person, but just something that you're studying so that you can distance yourself from it.
I think a little bit of distance is necessary. You can't completely distance yourself from it. But a little distance is a good thing, because otherwise you start getting subconsciously wrapped up and what might have happened to the individual just before they died. When you do that, I think you introduce an unconscious bias into what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. What are your tools when you're called to examine a corpse? What do you show up with?
Well, basically I tend to travel fairly light when I go out, mainly because I'm on a motorcycle when I get there. But I have a collapsible insect net. I have my collecting kit, which consists of a whole series of forceps and various and sundry scraping implements, a couple of knives, scalpels, a series of vials, and a couple of rearing chambers, and that's pretty much it.
What do you have to do to protect your health when you're around these insects and the decomposing body?
Well, it's probably the one item that I'm always certain that I have with me that I forgot to mention because it's second nature, is I have a whole series of rubber gloves and usually some kind of a respirator that goes with me.
Is that to cleanse the air or to protect you from the smell?
More to cleanse the air. It doesn't really do too much in terms of the smell. The best thing for the smell is breathe through your mouth, because it won't get nearly as much as if you breathe through your nose.
Yeah, but I imagine you don't really feel like opening your mouth when you're around that.
Well, it's kind of a lesser of two evils. No, it's basically you have a respirator over it, so that's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you can tell by analyzing the insects in a decomposing body is where that body had been and whether the body has been moved, because there are different insects in different areas. And I imagine there's different insects in cities than there are in the country. What's the difference between the insect population that will feed on a corpse in an urban area compared to the insects in a rural area?
You know, we have this idea of what we call synanthropy, or a level or degree of association with humans. Many of the species of flies are going to feed on decomposing material, but some will be more closely and specifically associated with man than other species. So they're both looking for the same type of resource, but they're looking for it in different places. So you may have, an example, one of our flies, Synthesia myonudicida, which occurs in Hawaii in strictly urban types of situations and likes to be in houses. On the other hand, we have some calliforid flies, Chrysomya megacephala and Chrysomya rufifaces, which really prefer to be out of doors. They don't like being indoors. Synthesia myonudicida doesn't want to go outdoors and lay its eggs on something. So if you find something outdoors with that particular species of fly on it, you know that at some point or another, this most probably was in an indoor situation and was later moved to an outdoor type of situation.
Now, when you're trying to study the insect population that feeds on decomposing bodies, the surrogate for the human body that you use is a dead pig. Why dead pigs? Are they similar to human bodies? Or
really, the 50-pound domestic pig is much more similar to a human body than you might actually think. What we're looking at really is the material in the trunk and the material in the head, and we're not worried too much about what goes on in the arms and legs. In terms of physiology, in terms of the manner in which they decompose, they're the thing that most closely approximates human decomposition. They're readily available and not all that expensive, so they've turned to be a very good animal model.
My guest is forensic entomologist Lee Goff, author of A Fly for the Prosecution. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Lee Goff is a forensic entomologist. He studies the insects living in recently discovered decomposing corpses. The insects offer clues about the time of death and other pertinent information. Now, I was interested reading your book that one of the things that you can do now as a forensic entomologist is to help determine whether the dead person had taken cocaine or heroin or other drugs before death by studying the presence of cocaine or heroin in the insect population that's living in the corpse. Is that something that you discovered you could do?
I think that probably the original work was done by some pathologists, toxicologists, back around 1979, 1980, when they were faced with a body where there wasn't enough flesh left to actually do a toxicological analysis, but there were some maggots present. And they were able to pick up some of the barbiturates by analyzing the maggots, but it kind of sat there. With the drug problems that came up in more recent years, and taking a look at a couple of cases that I had, I began to wonder, not only could we detect the drugs, but what would be the effect on maggot development when the maggot was actually ingesting those materials.
What have you learned?
Well, what I have found is that basically almost all the substances that we have tested, and we've included cocaine, heroin, amphetamines, the new drug ecstasy, old angel dust, and some of the tricyclic antidepressants such as amitriptyline, all of these have an effect on the growth patterns of the maggots. And in order to make an accurate estimate of the period of development, you have to know whether or not these drugs were present in the body.
One of the things I couldn't help but think about reading your book was how when you see an insect like an ant or a spider, or certainly a maggot, you never know where has this insect been before coming to my picnic or coming to my kitchen.
Yeah, that's true. Depending on the insect, you could be somewhat suspicious and worried, and other insects you wouldn't worry about that much.
Is this the kind of thing that bothers you, I mean, with everything that you know?
Not really. I think just kind of something you accept. If you start worrying about where everything is walked, then pretty soon you're going to find yourself in a position where you're becoming very paranoid.
Do you have a great respect and admiration for insects, even though many of us find them quite creepy?
Oh, yeah, they're fascinating. You take a look at them, they're some of the most successful organisms on Earth. They're remarkable in terms of the structure, the morphology, the manner in which they survive, their developmental patterns. Tremendously fascinating insects.
Now, some of the insects that you deal with are the insects that we find particularly repellent because they're found around things that are decaying and decomposing. What do you know about them that helps you admire them as opposed to just being, you know, disgusted?
Well, I think it's when you take a look at how beautifully they are constructed to perform that particular function of recycling, breaking down material, how nicely this whole thing fits into the whole scheme of life.
Tell us something about the maggot that you find fascinating.
Well, basically, you have a tremendously evolved eating machine. I mean, the only thing that this particular beast is designed to do is to feed, get larger, do that as efficiently as it possibly can. It feeds in masses. It's more efficient feeding in a mass than it is by itself. You take a look at the breathing structures at the posterior end of the body, as opposed to the head, which is, again, more efficient in terms of the feeding activities. Just magnificently designed to perform a particular function.
How is the maggot designed to feed so efficiently?
In the feeding activity, they have what you call preoral digestion. And basically what that means is that they're going to digest the food that they want and ingest that instead of just taking things in and trying to process them all inside the body. So you have salivary enzymes that are going to be secreted and a pair of mouth hooks that are going to lacerate tissue. So the laceration combined with the salivary enzymes breaks down the food that they want, and then they just ingest that. It eliminates a lot of the necessity for waste handling.
Did you ever see the David Cronenberg version of The Fly with Jeff Goldblum?
Yes, actually that was one of the better examples of fly feeding activity. It was fairly realistic with the individual regurgitating back onto the food, which precisely is the manner in which the adult fly feeds.
Do you have kids?
Yes, I do.
What do they think of your work?
Well, they managed to survive their childhood. Too many traumas in there. My older daughter has gone into communications, and my younger daughter is now at UCLA majoring in anthropology. I went horribly wrong somewhere. All the entomology that came into the house, and she's working in anthropology. On the plus side, she's planning on conducting a decomposition study down in Belize for this coming summer. So it hasn't totally gone off the wall.
You know, in a lot of families, the kids try to gross out the parents by bringing bugs into the house. I guess it was the other way in your house.
Yeah, they both of them kind of grew up going out to look at dead pigs on occasion when I had to do sampling on the weekends. They kind of got used to it.
One of our producers was telling me a few days ago about an article that she'd read in which there was, like, in a forest, a whole bunch of basically dead bodies that were there for research purposes. Are you familiar with this?
Oh, it sounds like she's talking about the body farm down in Knoxville.
That's exactly what it was.
Yeah. It's Bill Bass's anthropological facility down there.
What's that about?
Well, he started it, I guess, back in the late 70s. And they're trying to actually explore different changes that occur to the human body from an anthropological viewpoint when they're left out. They've done some entomological work down there. In fact, Bill Rodriguez, who's with the Armed Forces Medical Examiner, was one of the students very early on working on decomposition. He did some entomological work with it. But it's been primarily an anthropological focus.
You know that kids rhyme? Our version was, did you ever see a corpse go by and feel that you were the next to die? The worms crawl in, the worms crawl out, they chew your guts and they spit them out. Have you thought at all about what you want for yourself when you know, what you want for your body after you pass? Whether you want to be buried, and if you think of the insects,
Well, actually,
that will come afterwards?
My plans for my body, insects haven't figured into it too much. I'm planning on cremation and having my ashes scattered in my favorite surfing spot.
That sounds good. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Lee Goff's new book is called A Fly for the Prosecution, How Insect Evidence Helps Solve Crimes. Coming up, a preview of our next program in our American Popular Song series. This is Fresh Air.